Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Please, Diane, please just do this for me and my family. Please tell us where my dad's body is. If you don't know and you weren't there, just like you and Stephen said, then where is he? You must know something, anything.
Welcome to Where is Bruce Shuler? A podcast into the disappearance of Bruce Shuler from Palmerville Station in July 2012. My name is Graham Crowley. Thank you very much for listening. This is episode 1, River of Gold. The podcast has been created for an adult audience, so listener discretion is advised. There is discussion about death. The thoughts and opinions in this podcast are mine. You just heard Lisa Shuler writing to convicted murderer Diane Wilson in 2022, begging her to disclose the whereabouts of her father Bruce. I interview Lisa and her mother Fiona in episode 2. Where is Bruce Shuler is my latest podcast. To my many loyal followers from my 3 previous podcasts, I thank you for your continued support. It is truly appreciated. To my new listeners, welcome. I understand I do have a new listener base to this podcast from the North Queensland region because of this case. This murder case naturally generated a huge amount of interest in the communities of the Atherton Tablelands, Cairns, and around the Cape York Peninsula. I'm sure my listeners from other parts of Australia, New Zealand, USA, Canada, UK, and Europe, to name a few, will be interested in the locality of this crime. It is another beautiful and amazing part of Queensland. I am continually amazed where I receive messages from in the world from people listening and commenting on my podcast, and I really appreciate it. Thank you. I have previously broadcast podcasts called Bring Home Sandrine, Loose Ends, The Singh Family Tragedy, and Who Killed Leanne Holland. If you are unaware of them, you may consider listening to them also. I have placed links to all my podcasts in the show notes of this episode. I have also added links to the Facebook pages Justice for Bruce Shuler and Graham Crowley Podcast Investigations. I am excited to report that national television station Channel 9 is broadcasting documentaries on 2 of those cases due for release in February 2024. Channel 9 picked up the stories from my podcasts. I'm just pleased that my work is being noticed. Actually, I have suggested to one of the producers, perhaps they look at the Palmerville murder as a basis for a documentary. It is a fascinating and compelling true crime mystery, which I just love to podcast. Various photographs, mud maps, and diagrams of the Palmerville area and the location of the murder have been placed on both Facebook pages to help you navigate the background to what is generally known as a Palmerville murder. You will need to join either Fiona's Facebook page or mine to access the material. Fiona will be more than pleased to have you on board her Facebook page, and I will too, naturally. If you are reluctant to join Facebook groups, may I suggest you sign up and sign out once you have viewed the material. The material will give you a very clear understanding of the background and the location of this murder. I hope I can live up to the very favourable feedback I continue to receive from my previous podcasts. No pressure, much. More importantly, I hope I can help in some small way defining Bruce Shuler and bringing him home to his family. And stranger than fiction, Bruce Shuler went missing 4 days before Sandrine Jordan, the subject of my last podcast. And as with Sandrine, Bruce remains missing. And in Sandrine's case, there were 3 men, friends in her life, who became known as the Three Amigos. Just as Bruce was with 3 friends when he went missing. There have been 2 books written about this case. I speak with both authors in the podcast and will provide details of their books along the way in the event you're interested in reading them. At this time, I anticipate 7 episodes will be required to properly and thoroughly examine the case. I do hope you stick with me whilst we explore the background to the murder, the circumstances of the murder, the investigation and the trial, and the fallout throughout the community. This is not an open and shut murder, arrest and conviction by any means, as you will hear. To add to the mix, some claim there has been a miscarriage of justice here. Bruce Gavin Shuler, 48 years, was prospecting 3 other men when he disappeared on Palmerville Station, Far North Queensland, on Monday, 9 July 2012, more than 11 years ago now. Stephen Struber, then 55 years, and Diane Wilson, 53 years, leaseholders of Palmerville Station, were convicted of his murder at the Supreme Court in Cairns in 2015 and sentenced to life imprisonment. And as you heard, Bruce Shuler's remains have never been found. And that is where the story seemingly ended, but didn't. The majority of my listeners may not have heard of the murder of Bruce Shuler. And there are very valid reasons for that. It occurred in a very isolated area of North Queensland. And I mean a very isolated area. And it was initially a missing person case. A missing prospector on the goldfields. Murder charges were not laid for almost 4 months. There was media coverage, of course, but it was mainly confined to North Queensland as far as I can determine. Certainly it was reported in and around Cairns, and some information filtered out from there, but it appears not much other than to Brisbane. Whilst the case had significant and continuing impact in the local community, it may not have resonated with the greater population for those reasons. Sad to say, perhaps, but in our busy lives, bombarded with news from around the world 24/7, it was just another missing person case. But Bruce's murder had far-reaching implications for criminal law in Queensland, as you'll hear later in the podcast. First, a bit of background about the location and the parties involved, and you may begin to understand why the murder flew under the radar. And for my North Queensland listeners, please humour me whilst I explain the beautiful part of Queensland where you guys live and work to my other listeners who may not have had the privilege of visiting, living or working in your area. Palmerville Station is situated some 300 kilometres northwest of Cairns, and Cairns is situated some 1,700 kilometres north of the capital city, Brisbane. In the 2016 census, Palmerville recorded 0 population. By then, the only 2 occupants were in prison. Palmerville Cattle Station is around 1,360 square kilometres in area, or roughly the same size as Hong Kong, with a rich history of gold, in an isolated and sometimes lawless part of Australia. And some believe there are still big gold deposits to be discovered around the Palmer River goldfields. At the time of the murder, there were around 3,500 head of cattle on Palmerville, being run by a husband and wife team with some help. It must have been an enormous workload for all concerned. In 1994, a book was published about the region and named just that, River of Gold. These are two of the reviews written about the book at the time.
The Canberra Times wrote, "With cannibal blacks, pigtailed Chinamen in thousands, lynch law hangings, gambling dens, shanty towns, murders, grog shops and Italian opera singers, the Palmer River goldfields, properly spun out, should provide enough television material for general exhibition for the next 10 years. This one book, River of Gold, could easily be used as the jumping off ground for the lot." The Bulletin wrote, "The gold rush at Palmer River on Cape York lasted about 7 years in the 1870s, but with 35,000 diggers, it was this country's wildest while it lasted."
It was never established how much gold was found on the Palmer River during the gold rush, but estimates have been given at around 1 million ounces. At today's price, that would be around $2 billion. An extraordinary amount of money and a big incentive to put up with the deprivations and the risks of mining in Australia's far north in the late 1800s. Palmerville Station falls within the Cook Shire. The Cook Shire covers this area, the area around the town of Cooktown, and goes all the way north to the Torres Strait Islands. Currently, the estimated population of the Cook Shire is 4,700 people, and it was named, incidentally, after James Cook, who charted the area. Maytown was the main town of the Palmer River's goldfields, but it's been a ghost town since the mid-1900s. The post office closed around 1945, sealing its fate. Palmerville Station lies another 40 kilometres west of where Maytown stood. I had not heard of Maytown nor Palmerville till I came across this case. And I had lived in Townsville for more than 10 years and travelled to Cairns regularly. Around half of the population of the Cook Shire live in Cooktown, with most others living in smaller towns scattered around the shire. Cooktown is quite an isolated part of the state, unless, of course, you live in Cooktown, and then it's just your home. To give you an idea of what we're talking about here, there are around 70 cattle properties in the Cook Shire of 50,000 hectares or less. By comparison, Palmerville has 135,000 hectares, huge and isolated and wild country. And added to the isolation is the extreme climate. This whole area has a tropical climate, hot wet summers, warm dry winters, very wet summers, monsoonal. The entire area becomes impassable by road. And hot dry winters, not just warm dry winters. The daytime temperature in winter is usually around 30 degrees Celsius. Many prospectors and tourists do visit the area. It is a mecca for grey nomads. Palmerville Station falls within the Lawra Police Division, Queensland's only one-man police station, or it was at the time. Imagine an area the size of Hong Kong with one man policing it. That was Lawra. It is an 80-kilometre drive from Lawra Police Station to Palmerville Station. 80 kilometres, normally perhaps a 45-minute trip. In this area, over rough dirt roads and tracks, allow around 2 to 3 hours to cover that distance. Bob Hayden was a police officer for 36 years. He served at Lawra from 1991 until his retirement in 2002, 11 years. I have never met Bob, but I bet he had some stories to tell about his patch. He also had a mining lease in the Palmer River goldfields from 2000 to 2005. You could say he had seen, lived and worked the area from both sides of the fence. Bob knew Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson. He knew Diane's parents when they owned the property. He had stayed overnight in Palmerville Station whilst patrolling his division. He had heard of the bullying, the threats and harassment attributed to Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson. It was alleged he'd called it a time bomb waiting to happen. Bob Hayden is now very ill and unable to be interviewed. He conducted investigations in this murder case after he retired from the police. I have been given some of the material he gathered on the case. You will hear some of what he found later in the podcast. I was fortunate to do a road trip through this area in 2021. We travelled by road from Mareeba on the Atherton Tablelands to Cooktown via Lakeland, a distance of around 300 kilometres. We stopped at the Palmer River Roadhouse for fuel. Situated on the banks of the Palmer River, this is a roadhouse in the middle of nowhere. There are no houses or other buildings within probably 50 kilometres. There is limited or no telephone reception and no internet reception. Fuel, food and drink prices are commensurate with the isolation of the area. Most people travelling through the area stop at the roadhouse. It is possible to park up behind the roadhouse for the night in your car, camper, caravan or swag. A safe option to camping on the side of the road in the middle of a very remote part of Australia. I was aware of the Palmville murder by that time and considered driving up to Palmville and Maytown to scout out the area. Whilst it was only 130 kilometres, it was over winding, mountainous terrain on rough roads, a six-hour return trip, and totally unsuitable to tow the caravan up there. We continued on to Cooktown instead. Palmer River Roadhouse is located on the main and only road to Cape York, the northernmost part of Australia. Anyone who has been to the Cape, as it is known, would have passed by the Palmer River Roadhouse. To many, especially Queenslanders, a pilgrimage to Cape York is almost a rite of passage, but not something to be undertaken lightly. After all, it is 1,000 kilometres from Cairns to the northern tip of Australia by road. The roads are mostly rough, dirt for the majority of them, with many creek crossings and impassable in the wet season from around November to April. But unless you have an interest in mining or fossicking or live in the Cookshire, you may be unaware of the history of the area as you pass through. Once police became involved in the disappearance of Bruce Shula on 10 July 2012, George Wilson, brother to Diane Struber and brother-in-law to Stephen Struber, provided a 20-page statement to investigating detectives. It described life at Palmville and the principal players in words and in a way I simply never could. It is way better you hear George's description of life on Palmville. These are his words, but not his voice.
George Thomas Wilson states, "I'm a 43-year-old male. I'm currently living on Palmerville Station. I know Diane Wilson Struber. She is my sister. I have known her all my life. I get on very well with her. I know Stephen Struber. He is my brother-in-law. I used to get on well with him. I don't get on with him much at all these days. My father, Alfred Wilson, got this Palmerville property by ballot in 1964. I've lived at Palmerville off and on my whole life. My mother's name is Doris Wilson. Palmerville Station is a cattle station called Palmerville Holding and is 840 square kilometres by 525 square mile, or roughly 136,000 hectares. Palmerville is a pastoral holding. It is leased from the government. However, these leases can be sold. That is, you can sell what remains of the lease to another pastoralist at a price agreed to by both parties. In 1984, I was working at the Noel Adams mine, about 8 miles downriver from the homestead here on Palmerville. I first met Stephen Struber there, as he was working there as a mechanic. In 1986, I offered Stephen some work as a mechanic on the station here at Palmerville. He would just work for hourly rate as a mechanic. In 1987, Stephen started working here full time. He started seeing my sister Diane in about 1987. I believe Stephen had a missus and kids back in Malanda at the time. Stephen worked on until about 1989, when we ran out of work for him. I think he went back to his missus for a bit and was carting bagasse for one of the mills. Then he came back up here in around 1992 and was doing a bit of mining around here and would do a bit of work for us as well. Dad died in 1985 at the age of 75. At that time, the lease at Palmerville was transferred to my mother, Doris Wilson, and then she owned the lease. In 1996, Stephen left again. He came back in 1997 and 1998 and did bits and pieces of work for us and a bit of his own work mining around here. I believe he and Diane were on and off around this time. In 1999, he was carting cattle for a neighbour. He would collect cattle from here to take to the sale yards in Mareeba. When he came to get the cattle, he would help us in the yards as well. I think he started up with Diane again at this time. I was on the property full time up until the end of 2000. I had a wife back then. She is now deceased. By the end of 2000, she wanted to leave the property. She did not like the way Stephen spoke to her. This was not the only reason she left. Myself and my wife moved away to Dimboola then. My wife died in 2001, June 16. Mum continued to own the lease at Palmerville until 2001. In 2001, the lease was transferred to Diane and Stephen. They didn't actually purchase it, but they borrowed money and paid Mum's debt and paid me some money that they felt was owed to me in wages for the work that I'd put into the station for free, given that I was now not able to run the property by myself, as my wife would not stay. Diane and Stephen have had Palmerville since then. I've lived at the main homestead since then. They have had people working for them on and off. In 2001, Russell worked here for about 2 months full time. Stephen had a young fellow working for him in about 2004. In 2008, Stephen hired two of Mick's men for mustering. At different times, my sisters Narelle and Julie worked here. Also, Bruce reworked here for Stephen from time to time. He has a mining lease in the Maytown area. Catherine worked here on and off in 2002, 2004, 2005 and 2006. She would be about 26 years old now. Apart from that, it has mostly been me. In terms of who lives at Palmerville at the present time, I have my gear in the second room on the right. I camp in the back room on the left. Diane is in the caravan to the left of the house. I never go inside the van. Stephen camps mostly in the van, but sometimes in the house, sometimes in the shed. I don't know why Diane does not camp in the house. I think it is because she initially moved into the van before she was with Steve when Mum and Dad were still alive and she just stayed there. As at Monday 9 July 2012, the only people who would be available to answer the phone at Palmerville Homestead are Diane and Stephen. There was no one else living or visiting Palmerville at the time. About a month ago, I half moved up to Cannibal Creek. This is a location within Palmerville Station, about 75 kilometres away from the homestead. I basically have an agreement with Steve and Diane, sublease 50 square miles around Cannibal Creek. I'm in the process of starting a camp there with the idea of running my own cattle. There is an existing camp there which consists of five little two-bedroom buildings. They are in a poor state of repair. There are a set of yards there. It normally takes 2.5 hours to drive from Palmerville to Cannibal Creek if you don't stop. I helped Stephen and Diane muster here at Palmerville on 16 and 17 June 2012. On 18 June, I drove up to Cannibal Creek by road, basically moving up here to stay. I made an arrangement to speak to Diane on the phone every afternoon at about 6:30 p.m. We made that time that I would ring her or she would ring me just to make sure I was fine, hadn't been bitten by a snake or had an accident or whatever. I have a sat phone. I think I would ring Di on her phone number and would speak with her up to 10 minutes each day. This was mainly just to check how I was. Diane would talk about how the cattle were doing. I remember speaking to Diane on the phone on Wednesday, 4 July 2012. Diane told me that they had done a killer, that is, killed a cow for meat, upriver on the property, from what I could gather. She told me that they had seen a bit of activity where motorbike and vehicle tracks had been moving around. Apart from this, in the time that I had spent at Cannibal Creek, Diane did not mention any further problems that they were having with trespassers or prospectors. After going back to Cannibal Creek on 18 of June, I stayed at the Cannibal Creek area until Wednesday 11 July 2012 and did not come home to the Palmerville homestead or anywhere up this end of the property at that time. Whilst at Cannibal Creek, I went over to Stoney, an old township about 15 kilometres away along the Jessop's Road. I'd been there a couple of times and did some metal detecting. I've been over to Howden's Dam to do some prospecting as well. With the expectation of a trip to Maytown I did on 29 June 2012 with my brother-in-law Tony, I've not been outside that area I was leasing, which is the 50 square miles around the camp. Tony and his worker Gordon came to visit on 27 June 2012. On 29 June, I took them up to Maytown for a drive around there. We went past Dan's house and some of the old mine sites there. We went to see Bruce Ree on the way home. I met a fellow Charlie along the road that day also. Gordon and Tony went home on the Saturday morning, 30 June. On Sunday afternoon, 8 July 2012, my sister Sharon and her man Tony came into my camp and bought me some supplies. They stayed the night and left at about 9 a.m. Monday 9 July 2012. They were going to continue onto Lakefield to do some fishing. On Monday 9 July 2012, Sharon and Tony left me in the morning. After this, I went for a ride up to the back fence just to see what the cattle were doing. I was riding on a motorbike over there, a Suzuki 200. I got back about lunchtime, had a bit of lunch and did some cleaning on the lower hut. I did that till dark and went over to the camp and knocked up a bit of food. At about 6:30 p.m. Monday 9 July 2012, I rang Diane to check in as normal and told her that Sharon had got away all right. I told her that I had a look at the cattle at my end that day and that the cattle had been getting a bit quieter. I told her it would be worth doing a muster later. I remember Diane told me a bit of how the station was going. I remember she mentioned having cut some Mickey bulls, that means castrated some Mickey bulls, the day before, being Sunday. She hadn't mentioned it on the Sunday because Sharon had been with me and Sunday's check-in call had only been quick. Diane did not tell me about any problems. I did not detect any problem in her voice. Diane mentioned that Stephen had been working on the loader, as in repairing it, to get it ready to do some work in the water tanks. On Tuesday morning, 10 July 2012, it was a bit drizzly, so I did not do much in the morning. At about 11 a.m. I went down to Greasy Bill Creek at the bottom of Howden Dam. Greasy Bill Creek runs into Oakey Creek, which runs into Sandy Creek. I went down there and took the pan just to look for spots along the creek that might be good for prospecting. I was riding the motorbike along the creek bed and bank. It was pretty slow going. This is within the 50 square miles that I am subleasing from Stephen and Diane. I covered about 4 or 5 miles along the creek. I did this until about 3 p.m. in the afternoon. I went back to the camp, got some water and firewood. At about 5:45, I saw a big helicopter heading due east. I thought this would mean trouble, as this helicopter is normally only used if people are hurt or lost. Because of this, I started ringing a little bit earlier than usual, at about 6:10 p.m. I did not get an answer. I would have rung about 3 times between 6:10 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. Di watches home and away, so I did not ring between 7 and 7:30, and tried again a little later after 7:30 p.m. In one of the calls, probably the second last one, I left a message on the phone and said something like, "All is okay here." I did not call again after that. The next morning, Wednesday 11 July 2012, I rang Palmerville at about 6:30 a.m. and a few more times until about 7 a.m. a male person answered the phone. I knew it was not Stephen Struber or Diane. The phone dropped out a few times because I was on the sat phone. I did call again, but no one answered the phone. At about 7:30 a.m. 11 July, I rang my brother-in-law Paul and asked him what was going on. He told me that Diane and Stephen were in the watch house and could I go and look after the animals on the property.
A I speak with George later in the podcast. Some murder cases you study have a cast of thousands, so to speak. The Singh triple murder in Brisbane in 2003 comes to mind. In that investigation, police took over 1,100 statements and had a potential witness pool of almost 800 witnesses. Over 1,500 crime scene photographs were taken. The trial lasted more than 60 days, but not Palmville. Apart from the police officers who gave evidence, there were a few witnesses who added brief evidence to the storyline, and the three gold prospecting companions of Bruce Shuler. That's it. The trial lasted 8 days, and of those 8 days, 2 days were spent transporting the jury, barristers, judge, the defendants, bailiff, and supporting staff from Cairns to Palmville and back to enable everyone to view the crime scene, a distance of some 1,200 kilometres for a group of around 30 people. Imagine travelling 1,200 kilometres just to view a crime scene and then returning to court to hear the evidence. When I first read the trial transcript, read the media stories, all sensational, some bordering on hysterical, as well as the two books written on the case, I felt I had a fair understanding of the circumstances of the murder. I was beginning to wonder if there was even enough material to produce more than a two-episode podcast. I considered the police detectives had conducted a thorough investigation into the disappearance of Bruce Shuler, an investigation made even more difficult by the tyranny of distance. I hope to have a former detective on the podcast in a later episode who can talk us through the investigation. I thought the legal representation of the defendants was lacking. I am acutely aware the level of legal representation you receive in this country is directly related to your bank balance. That probably applies to all countries that practice the adversarial system of law. I considered the defendants were likely asset rich and cash poor, not unlike many other people who make their living on the land in Australia. It can be a feast or a famine, depending mainly on Mother Nature. And I also considered the defendants would likely be naive of the complexities of the criminal law, particularly in a homicide case, as most people would expect to be. But more about that later. There are a number of important witnesses and locations connected with this case. You will hear about them throughout the podcast. Dan Bidner, Tremaine Anderson, and Kevin, known as Rusty Groth, were the three prospecting friends of Bruce you will hear a lot about. You will hear about the police mechanic. The important locations connected with the crime are contained in the mud maps you will find in the two Facebook pages. But they include Rosie's Creek, where Bruce Shuler had his mining lease, Maytown, where prospector Dan Bidner lived, the homestead on Palmville Station, located on the southern side of the Palmer River. The Palmer River itself, which winds its way through Palmville for over 70 kilometres. The prospector's campsite, located about 2 kilometres east of the homestead on the Palmer River. The gully where the murder occurred, generally known as the 1 mile, and located about 1 kilometre east of the homestead on the other, or northern side of the Palmer River. The 2 mile, an area on Palmville where the prospectors did some prospecting, also on the other side of the homestead, the northern side. The Crockhole, where tourists and prospectors sometimes camped, located about 12 or 15 kilometres east of the homestead. And Kennebal Creek, still on the property, but located some 75 kilometres north of the homestead. And you'll also hear of the two motor vehicles owned by the Strubers. Both were Toyota 4x4 Land Cruiser Utilities. Both were fawn in colour. One old, tired, unregistered, just a bush basher, which had a cab and a flat metal tray back. That is, the tray had no sides.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Poor brakes. No handbrake. Bald tyres. Extremely difficult to get into first and second gear. The bush basher plays a significant and crucial part in the narrative. The other Toyota, the registered 4x4, had a cab with a tray back and sides. It was roadworthy and in good mechanical condition. Struber and Wilson had a long history of objecting to prospectors coming onto their property. In fact, they had a reputation for not liking anyone coming onto their property. They claimed the prospectors lit fires to burn off the grass to assist in metal detecting. The prospectors interfered with their cattle, they claimed. They left gates open, they said. And they generally disrupted the running of the station. There was, at the time of the murder, 33 granted mineral exploration permits on Palmville, 23 applications for mineral production permits, and 95 granted mineral production permits. I think it would be fair to say prospectors were coming and going all the time on and around Palmerville. But when it is the size of Hong Kong, you may never cross paths. I'm aware that in the 3 year period up to 2012, Struber had objected to almost all of those applications for new leases in the Land Court. It was to the law firm who acted for him in the Land Court over mining permits that Struber turned to when he and Diane were arrested for murder. Other prospectors were entitled to go on the property, providing they gave several days' notice to the leaseholders. But most never bothered. They just turned up and commenced prospecting. And that seemed to be the norm, I found. Perhaps it was because the road ran through the property. Or perhaps travellers simply didn't understand the size of the property. When I was living in Townsville, we would often go shooting on bush properties outside Townsville, as far south as Bowen and west of Charters Towers. We would never contemplate going onto a property without first contacting the owner. It was just the accepted practice. Trespassing was never considered okay. I have been struck by the casual attitude people, particularly prospectors, had in relation to Palmville. Former Courier Mail journalist, author, and long-time North Queensland resident, Robert Reed, published his book, Murder on the River of Gold, The Palmerville Station Murder, in 2019. These are his words, but not his voice.
It was the beginning of a reign of standover tactics that went unchecked for 20 years. Despite their activities becoming widely known to workers, miners, and the travelling public, Stephen and Diane forged a Bonnie and Clyde reputation for themselves, revelling in the untouchable powers they believed was their right, the right to defend their land at all times.
I speak with Robert Reed later in the podcast, and more about the confrontations between Struber and Wilson with trespassers in episode 3. As luck would have it, or fate perhaps, a journalist interviewed Stephen Struber on Palmerville in May 2012, just 2 months before the murder. Older Australians may remember TV personality Monty Dwyer, affectionately known as the Weatherman, on Breakfast Television. Monty brazenly turned up on Palmville Station, unannounced, and challenged Struber about his reputation. This is Monty's interview.
Things being written that you stake tyres and that you have challenged people with a rifle and shot at people, and is there any truth in
that? No, there's none. Well, I've never staked anyone tyres on purpose at all. I've put out material to prevent anyone coming onto our workplaces. So when we're working, there's no shooting and that, because Diane over the years has been down having lunch and that, and there's been bullets whistling over her and her brother and a few others in the camp head at lunchtime due to people shooting. We've lost herd bulls and that. With people shooting them. The same with machinery. You go to machinery and leave it along the track and you come back and there's no battery in it and the fuel's drained and that, you can't afford to leave it along the track. Come across cattle shot and only the rump taken out. Or brisket. It's our livelihood. They shouldn't be here. So we put in devices to protect ourselves. It's only the people that I find on the property, and when we go and talk to them, what are you doing here? Why, do you own the place? They're the ones that make it hard for me. They're the ones that are passing the word around that he's a bad bloke. And as far as we're concerned, if the council wants to open the road and that up, work in with us. Work in with the people of the area so the tourists that come through, they get the best benefit of the area without annoying the landholders in the area, whereas this council hasn't. There's been three other townships that they could have come in on to visit through to Maytown. There's Byerstown, Ewerstown and Maytown. There's a gazetted road right past them. No resumption orders are needed. Just do the road up.
They
didn't want that because it looked like too much hard work. There's a road over here, we'll take it. At the present time, they've taken lots. 1 to 13, minus 5. Now 6 goes out into the neighbouring property, comes around and joins back in. Why would they want a road out there for?
So you think this is part of the vendetta?
Yeah, because if they really wanted number 9, we look at it, it'd be number 1. What they've done to us here with section 11, the gazetted alignment goes through here and down there, but they wanted section 11 and it comes up here and across here, so they've got two roads running side by side. And the biggest issue here is number 13. It only goes out from Palmerville here a kilometre and it's our airstrip, and they've put the road right beside our airstrip that we haven't been able to receive mail now since September last year. We haven't had mail since the 5th of September 2011. And now it's April 2012.
It's May
2012. And we haven't had no mail at all. In the wet season, we normally get even supplies to come in. Nothing.
So you can't use that airstrip?
At the present time, that airstrip is not ours. It's on a road reserve.
You don't think some of your angst is spilling over to the passers-by? You know, I mean, You have a reputation for being quite, you know, giving people a bit of curry up on the road. You don't think
that's all been blown out of proportion.
What do you think about the possibility that this road, if the council do go ahead with this compulsory acquisition, this country opening up to the grey nomads and, you know, people starting to use that loop more regularly? How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm okay with it. As long as my cattle and that ain't on the road to cause any problems to the next bloke, and they're not causing me no problems. No. Life goes on.
I have placed a link in the show notes if you wish to watch Monty's interview on YouTube. Recently I spoke with Monty regarding his interview with Stephen Struber.
The way it happened was I was researching material for the previous book, which was The Nomads at Large, which was my take on the whole grey nomad phenomenon in this country, having a look at how it's impacting the country, the winners, the losers, where it's going from here. And so I was going around and trying to find different angles to that. And when I was in North Queensland, I heard about this couple of people, the Strubers, out there on their property at Palmerville Station, giving people a little bit of curry going through, you know. I mean, they were known they were reputed to pull people up and give them a hard time, especially miners, occasionally travellers and campers, you know, fire shots. This is, once again, allegedly fire shots. And I thought, well, that's an interesting angle on the whole grey nomad business, because they're pulling their caravans through this property and getting bailed up by these guys. I'll go in and talk to them. Now, that rolls off my tongue nicely at this stage of the game, but I can assure you I wasn't feeling as brave at the time as I sound right now. Because the night before, I thought, oh, go in, yeah, all right, okay, suck it up, Monty, and go in. And the night before I went in, I happened to spend with Dan Bidner and his wife, Jo. who at that stage owned Butcher's Creek, which is the only freehold property within the Goldfields area there. And I spent the night with them. Now, Dan had had a bit to do with his troopers and bite me all night with stories of what they'd done. And so when I set off to go in on my own, I was, partially terrified, I suppose. I'm not ashamed to say I was a little disconcerted. But when I got there, to balance it out, I mean, I jumped out and at the other end, I said, look, I've heard everybody else's side of the story. I'm here to give you an opportunity to tell yours. And they took it, for which I was grateful. But not only that, I have to say they were polite to me and gracious hosts. So they didn't bring out the sandwiches and the tea, but he certainly gave me an interview, which Stephen did, and covered the ground I asked him to. And I pushed him pretty hard on his reputation. And they were gracious enough to let me camp on the river. So personally, I haven't got any bad words to say about the Stroopers, of course. What went on thereafter was beyond control. Yeah. Yeah.
I'd read about all this stuff that was going on and people being threatened and stuff like that. And I thought, and then I found your YouTube and I went, wow, Monty's gone on there and fronted him. It's a big effort.
Yeah. Like I said, I wasn't as brave going in as I may sound now. And when I'm selling the books over the, in the shops, people often say, were you scared? Yep, I was. There are times you just got to suck it up and go in. And I'm glad I did, because it opened up. Obviously, it helped me produce a book, and it also taught me a lot about human nature. The urge for vengeance is not as strong, I learn, as the urge for bringing your loved one's remains home.
Yeah.
And it's a very strong urge, like Fiona and her kids, still tortured by it.
Tell me about it, I've interviewed Fiona and Lisa, and she almost had me in tears.
Absolutely.
I think it's going to be a very powerful episode when I put her on. But listen, when I watched that YouTube, Monty, Struber came across quite rational. What was your take on that?
Yeah, I thought he was just, maybe stitched a bit tight, but I thought he was rational. And I think, as I said in the book before, the Nomads at Large book, I thought it sounded like he had a case. And because I was going west and not east, I couldn't cross-check that. I couldn't go back to the Cook Shire and cross-check a lot of the stuff that he told me about the widening of the narrowing of the airstrip so he couldn't get the mail in and those sorts of things. And I'm quite, usually there's two sides to the story. And there are probably a lot of those things that did bear truth, but I couldn't go back and cross-check.
Sure, of course.
So, yes, I thought he was pretty reasonable with what he said. But, of course, then we get back to what happened thereafter.
Yeah.
Tended to make mockery of maybe I was being a bit generous. But that's what I thought. I thought he was pretty reasonable. He answered my questions pretty reasonably. And I left thinking, I get that, Farmers get pissed off with people going through their properties and, especially shooting cattle and leaving gates open and lighting fires. Mm. And this sort of behaviour had been going on for some years, back with Diane's mother went through it as well and father. They all had to put up with that because it's a Goldfields area and people go in there and they don't always behave themselves. So, you can understand.
Yep. Did you see him give evidence at the Supreme Court trial?
No, but I missed it.
Because my next question was going to be, how did he present as a witness at the trial?
It seems to me, from the people I spoke to and the transcript itself, he probably shouldn't have taken the stand.
Right.
I don't think he did himself any favours by doing so.
Well,
because he ended up admitting that he could get the vehicle into
first gear. Yeah, and that's played on my mind, yeah.
That's right. That was a crucial point in the testimony. So that was one of the reasons. And I think when there was some remark he made about, you know, someone said, "Do you love Diane?" And he didn't answer the question directly. He said something like, "I care for her," or something. Those sorts of things do have an impact on jurors.
Didn't do himself any favours.
No, I don't think he did. I mean, that's my take on it.
Yeah. Most cases, the defence barristers tell their clients, do not take the stand. Do not take the stand.
Yeah.
It's a brave defendant who does.
He did it. And I don't think I think that turned it when he took the stand. Before that, it could have gone either way. And I think when he took the stand, he sort of cooked his own goose a little bit. But who's to know? This stuff sometimes turns on a two-word sentence, you know. Do you care for Diane?
Yeah.
Do you love Diana? I care for her. What's that, four words? Okay, I'm not very good at maths.
Monty has written a book on the murder, Struberville, Consequences of Isolation, a good read. You can buy his book on his website, monty.com.au, that's M-O-N-T-E. He has other books for sale on his website, including 5 works of non-fiction, 3 fiction, as well as DVDs and e-books. I have put a link in the show notes. Monty also kindly agreed to me using mud maps and photographs of his for this podcast. Bruce Gavin Schuler was born on 29 December 1964. As at the date of broadcast of this episode, Bruce would be shortly turning 60 years of age. I think everyone would agree 60 is an important milestone in life's journey, so perhaps it is prophetic that the podcast be broadcasting around his birthday. Bruce grew up on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. He was 48 years at the time of his disappearance on 9 July 2012. He was described as a builder and small business owner, but he retired early and was happy to go prospecting and spending time with his family. At the time of his disappearance, he lived in Mareeba with his wife of 27 years, Fiona Split. The couple had 2 grown children. Bruce loved gold prospecting as a hobby and just being in the bush. On 13 July 2012, the Courier-Mail published this story.
A prospector has vanished without trace on a search for elusive gold as police investigate reports of gunshots in the remote Palmer River goldfields on Cape York. His disappearance 5 days ago has baffled police as detectives investigate reports of gunshots in the area. It is harsh country. It is some of the hardest country you get anywhere in Australia. Detectives sought to question Palmerville Station lessee Steve Struber and his wife Diane over the alleged incident, but both refused to be interviewed and were released without charge yesterday. 2 helicopters, 15 police officers, a large contingent of SES crew and stock squad officers on horseback and quad bike are scouring rugged terrain with no trace of the missing experienced bushman since Monday. Mr. Struber is notorious for deterring fossickers and tourists from his cattle property over the years, police said. Steve Struber has been on a permanent war footing with miners, prospectors and four-wheel drive enthusiasts for years, Palmer River Goldfields expert George Mayer said yesterday. He has locked the gates, dug trenches in the road, the fossicker said. Inspector Mansfield said yesterday a major incident room has been set up and a criminal investigation was underway into the suspicious missing persons case. He said it was not beyond the realm of possibility the missing gold miner had fallen down a mineshaft.
The scene was set to suggest a motive for the murder. And then the curious comment, the missing miner may have fallen down a mineshaft. What was that about? Perhaps police at that time were unsure exactly what happened. In July 2015, Struber and Wilson were tried in the Cairns Supreme Court. The jury returned guilty verdicts of murder against both defendants after a surprisingly brief 4 hours of deliberation. A very compelling case by the sound of it. The Cairns Post wrote this the following day.
Tales of abuse, threats, weapons, booby traps and other disappearances have swelled for years. Travellers' blogs and online forums are littered with warnings about the tyrant landholders of Palmerville Station, aimed at those attempting to make the four-wheel drive trip along Palmer River Road. When police put out a public call for anyone who has faced hostility there in the past, they were inundated with complaints stretching back two decades. In fact, it was Tremaine Anderson, one of the three witnesses to Mr. Shuler's murder, who described being assaulted and having a rifle pointed at him by Struber, who demanded he leave the property back around 1992. Some of the more confronting historic tales came from Cook Shire Council workers, who had to remove illegal gates the couple had set up on Palmerville Road to block access. Cook Mayor Peter Scott, a friend of Mr. Shuler, admitted council workers were often forced to travel under police escort for their own safety. "I was told in the past, I never saw it myself, that he, Struber, has been armed, but nobody thinks that someone would take someone's life."
Once Struber and Wilson were convicted, the public trustee stepped in to manage their affairs. The management of their financial affairs is a battle that continues to this day. Eventually, the public trustee placed the property up for sale. When Palmerville Station was advertised for sale in 2019, the real estate agents advertised it this way.
"Palmerville Station is a lower peninsula grazing property located within the established beef cattle breeding area of North Queensland, located just 70 kilometres southwest of Laura, offering a total land area of 134,000 hectares of predominantly a mix of undulating ridge country comprising rough broken ranges associated with the Great Dividing Range, through the northern section intersected by several creeks and gullies extending to the south across eroded plains, with the main feature being the 70-kilometre double frontage to the Palmer River. Palmerville Station is known as one of Queensland's largest alluvial gold deposits and hosts 30-plus mining leases."
The property sold the same year for $4.07 million. The new owners continued to maintain the property as a pastoral lease. However, they also threw the property open to prospecting. The website www.palmervillegold.com.au was registered. The website promotes the business as a hub for staying and touring Palmerville Station. The website does contain maps and photographs of this area of Queensland if you're interested. The website provided this caution.
"On-site camping is available. Being in a highly remote area, you will need to be self-sufficient with all supplies, including food, water and accommodation. A first aid kit is also highly recommended. However, there will be a trained first aid officer available at all times on the property. Contact with Cannibal Creek Camp is via UHF 14.
Struber and Wilson appealed their conviction in the Queensland Court of Appeal in 2016. Both appeals were refused. Stephen Struber applied to the High Court of Australia to have his case heard. That application was refused. End of the road. As it was at the time, the killers would ordinarily be eligible for parole around the year 2030, or perhaps even before that. In 2017, that all changed. Fiona Split had gathered a petition of around 8,500 signatures, which was presented to Queensland Parliament in 2016. It was enacted by government and became known as the No Body, No Parole legislation. Under the legislation, the parole board must refuse to grant an application for parole where the offender is serving imprisonment for a homicide offence and the body or remains of the victim have not been located. No doubt many Queenslanders have heard about that legislation but may not have realised it came from this case. The Strubers will die in prison unless they disclose the whereabouts of Bruce's body, which they refuse to do. As at 2023, Stephen is 66 years of age and Diane 63 years of age. It is feasible they will have a further 20 plus years in prison before they die, after the time they could possibly walk free from prison. A big incentive to talk, in my opinion. As far as I'm aware, the last time anyone asked them face to face to disclose the whereabouts of Bruce's remains was 2019, 4 years ago. I want to find out whether anyone, relatives or friends, have recently spoken to them to see if they've reconsidered their position. And if they have not spoken to them, whether they will speak to them now and ask them. And then there is a suggestion of miscarriage of justice. Some people say the Strubers didn't commit the murder. Well, if they didn't commit the murder, who did? I want to explore those claims and see whether there is any truth to them or whether it is just rumour and gossip. I have been amazed at the incredible amount of rumour, gossip and innuendo swirling around this case and around Palmerville Station as well. So much to do. It seemed to me the case against Stephen Struber and Diane Wilson was a slam dunk. The case was circumstantial but compelling, which made me even more curious as to the evidence, if any exists, that there has been a wrongful conviction. And in case you are wondering what can cause a wrongful conviction, it varies from case to case. I believe, however, it is never just one factor. It is always a number of issues that must align, just like the planets. And from my experience and study, yes, I am fascinated by wrongful conviction cases. Common factors include, but are not limited to, witness misidentification, witnesses lying under oath, tunnel vision by investigators, poor police procedures or investigation, misconduct by police and or prosecutors, and poor legal representation of the defendants. Wrongful convictions fascinate me for a number of reasons. What causes them? How to spot them? And please do not interpret that as an indication I don't like to see people in prison. The opposite is actually true. I am more than happy for people to go to prison for crimes they commit, particularly murder. But I do prefer the right people to be in prison, not the wrong people. And I am not suggesting for a moment there has been a wrongful conviction here. But when I am pointed in the direction of a case with a suggestion of a wrongful conviction, I am hooked. I have already commented on the police investigation and the quality of the legal defence in this case. And that doesn't mean I go willfully looking to prove a miscarriage. I do go looking to see if there is any dishonest evidence or other factors. And this is actually a classic case to review. It is very hard to cross-check the evidence of a solo witness to a crime. But when you have three witnesses to the crime, it opens Pandora's box. No two witnesses are going to be able to ever give accounts that are consistent in every respect, of course. But for the big ticket items, the significant events, you'd expect there to be some level of consistency between their accounts. And there are any number of commonalities where you would be seeing consistency. Dates, times, locations, where the witnesses came from, what time they got there, who was there, what they saw, what they heard, what time they left, where they went to. And that's where the police come in. Part of their job is to cross-check and double-cross-check the witnesses' versions, to drill down and gather all the evidence, to ensure there's no collusion or fabrication by the witnesses. And then you can satisfy yourself you have truthful witnesses. And it wouldn't matter if the defendant's legal representation was a train wreck. One issue does not a miscarriage make, and I am yet to see more than one problematic issue in this case. That's it for episode 1, River of Gold. Thank you for joining me on this journey. For my new North Queensland listeners tuning in for this podcast, I hope you enjoyed it. If this is your first podcast rodeo, I do hope you gain something from it. I am aware Mareeba is a huge rodeo hub for Australia, so I could not help slipping that one in. Sorry. Well, not sorry. And there is an explanation I feel I need to make. Podcasts, even true crime podcasts, are considered entertainment. I've never been comfortable with describing a tragic murder as entertainment, but I'm sure the television and film industry would not necessarily agree with me. Someone's death and family's grief should not be considered entertainment. I prefer to believe my listeners leave with something, perhaps some insight into human behaviour or human psychology, or a better understanding of how our justice system works, or, as especially in this case, trigger some forgotten comment or throwaway line that may lead to information regarding the whereabouts of Bruce Shuler's remains, so that his family may get some closure. I am confident there are people listening to this podcast who have some information as to the whereabouts of Bruce Shuler. If you have a conscience, perhaps you can give the Shuler family a long overdue Christmas present. If you have any information on the whereabouts of Bruce Shuler's remains, or know someone who does, I urge you to message his widow Fiona or make contact through the Facebook page Justice for Bruce Shuler. Alternatively, you can contact me through Graham Crowley Podcast Investigations or at my email address, graeme5353@live.com, G-R-A-E-M-E 5353. If you require anonymity, you'll be absolutely assured your identity will remain hidden. Contact me anonymously if you wish. I don't care. It's just about finding Bruce. If you follow the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, you will be advised when a further episode is released. At this time, I plan to drop episodes weekly leading up to Christmas and then resume after Christmas. It would be Bruce's birthday at the end of December. I think it would be fitting to drop an episode on that date. Please join me in episode 2, Tsunami. Please rate and review the podcast. Reviewing a podcast makes the podcast more visible to others who follow true crime podcasts, as well as making me out to be a way better podcaster than I actually am. Please tell your family and friends about the podcast. Word of mouth is the best recommendation. My wish would be that all residents of North Queensland, from the Atherton Tablelands to Cairns, Laura, Cooktown and the Cape, hear about this case and start talking about it. And if you feel so inclined, you can support me for the one-off cost of a cup of coffee. Details in the show notes. And of course, if you have questions, information or feedback, you can contact me through the Facebook page or my email address. If you are aware of a murder case or similar where you believe justice has not been done, you may care to contact Scott Furlong and Associates, licensed private investigators, for assistance and advice. I have placed Scott's details in the show notes. This podcast was made possible with the grateful assistance of the Acast Creator Network. Music throughout the podcast by my friend Janet G. Janet lost her adult daughter in tragic circumstances 2 years ago. She is working through her grief via her music. Janet is very talented and has written some beautiful music, which you will find on her YouTube channel, JMG66. Or Janet G Music. Thank you, Janet. And as I only recently found out, Janet is related by marriage to Bruce Shuler. How appropriate and fitting. You'll find all my contact details in the show notes at the end of each episode, and thanks again for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.